after a violent end to months of protests. Thailand is facing its worst political crisis in decades. The country's army has dispersed the anti-government red shirts with brute force. Many of their leaders have been arrested and branded as terrorists. The razor wire and military checkpoints have disappeared from Bangkok's streets. But Thailand's problems are far from over.
In the past, there were political conflicts, political crises, but here the divisions are much deeper, and they are social as well. The divisions go right through society, at the national level, at the city level, in communities, in workplaces, in families even.
The protests and the army crackdown to end them have left Thailand a deeply divided nation. On May the 20th, 2010, the morning after one of the most violent days and nights in Thailand's modern history, the people of Bangkok woke up to a city destroyed. Columns of soldiers and convoys of military vehicles moved through smoke, debris, and deserted streets. In what used to be the heart of this city's bustling tourism and shopping district, it was now a scene of utter destruction and defeat. Just a day earlier, the area had resembled a war zone, as the tense two-month standoff between red-shirted protesters and government troops was abruptly ended. The Thai army broke through the tire and bamboo barricades of the red shirts and forced their leaders to surrender. Pitched battles ensued, but resistance was brief, and retreating protesters vented their anger at the physical symbols of Thailand's economic elite.
In all, around 37 buildings right across Bangkok were burned down, and they included banks, shops, and the stock exchange. But no building that was targeted for destruction was quite as iconic or as symbolic as this one. Central World, one of the largest shopping malls across Southeast Asia, and it burned for days after the army broke through the barricades of the protesters.
Bangkok's governor, Sukhumpan Boribhat, shared the sense of disbelief that had descended on the city's population as he surveyed the devastation.
Do you still find it shocking to sort of see the scale of destruction here at Central World?
I grew up in Bangkok. I was born in Bangkok, grew up in Bangkok, so it still shocks me, as it still does to most of the people in the city.
I mean, was it impossible to contain the level of violence, the level of destruction, once the protests had really reached their peak?
It was very difficult to contain, because the violence broke out very suddenly, but I think the violence had been planned very well. I mean, if you take a look around here, there were other possible targets, yet they chose the Central World building, which is probably the main symbol of commercial vitality.
When I last reported from Thailand in late 2009, the nation was convulsed by the sporadic protests of both the anti-government red shirts and the pro-government yellow shirts. Adding to the sense of uncertainty, the country's revered king, Bhumibol Adulyadej, had been hospitalized. And yet, although the demonstrations were frequent, they had a decidedly different mood. Sporadic outbursts of violence ended quickly, until March this year, when the red shirt sit-in began. The fighting and destruction of May the 19th captured the world's attention. In the months before that, the red shirts had taken to the streets to demand the resignation of Prime Minister Abhisit Wechachua. Tens of thousands of demonstrators stormed government buildings and occupied the city's shopping and tourism hubs. Chatupon Prompan, an opposition member of parliament, led many of those protests, which reached a new level when human blood was poured on the city's streets, an eerie portent of what was to come. On March the 28th, as the momentum and dramatic nature of the protests increased, the Prime Minister decided to meet with the red shirts. Chatupon was at the negotiating table.
If you are willing to give up, and if the people vote you in again, you will be a great Prime Minister.
But still the deadlock remained unbroken. And on the 10th of April, when the army tried to clear the red shirts from one of their camps, things spiraled out of control. At least 25 people, mostly civilians, were shot dead. Hundreds were injured. The red shirts held Abhisit directly responsible and demanded that he stand trial for the killings. The Prime Minister agreed to hold elections by the end of the year, but still, the red shirts refused to end their protests, claiming that they would do so only if a specific election date was announced.
Your goal is to change the government of Thailand, to get rid of Abhisit's government, which you claim is illegitimate, has been brought in by a coup d'etat. The quickest, most effective and recognisable way to achieve that is by agreeing to elections and not demanding that individuals be brought to trial.
We've seen orders to kill innocent civilians who were fighting for democracy. They were unharmed, with no guns in their hands. It's more important for someone to be held responsible for their loss of life than to have elections. The people who gave the order to kill these people cannot trade innocent lives for an election date. He has to be brought to justice. The election issue will only move forward if those responsible for the killings of civilians are brought to justice.
Abhisit withdrew his offer of elections and told the red shirts to either end the protest or face the consequences. And on May the 19th, after an increasingly tense standoff, those consequences were revealed in dramatic and deadly fashion. The army launched an all-out offensive on the demonstrators, determined to end the prolonged street-level sit-in. Many red shirt leaders either fled or surrendered.
If we hadn't surrendered that day, the casualties would be in the thousands. Everyone in front of the stage was willing to give up their lives. I couldn't bear to see the people getting hurt. We persuaded them to come for democracy and not to get killed.
For the governor of Bangkok, the physical rebuilding of Central World and the other charred buildings is the easy part. It will be a far more onerous task to heal the collective psyche of Bangkok's residents.
Another problem we have to face with is the question of psychological rehabilitation.
How big a problem is that?
The psychological impact has been enormous. The period between the 10th of April till the 19th of May has been the most tragic in the history of Bangkok. One of our old capitals, Ayutthaya, was burnt down 243 years ago. But then, in this case, we had the luxury of blaming on foreign invaders. This time, the trauma is caused by our own people. This trauma is caused by many of the people who live in Bangkok. So this has been a truly tragic, traumatic experience.
To many in Bangkok, the ruins of Central World have come to represent the struggle between the wealthy and the wanting. But what happened on that day, around the corner from this wreckage at the Wat Pathum Temple, is something that has come to symbolize the real personal tragedy of this political conflict. In a glitzy Bangkok neighborhood, the temple of Wat Pathum Wanaram stands quietly in between two shopping malls. A Buddhist sanctuary, a safe haven from the frenzy of modern life. This spiritual place became a government-designated safe zone and found itself at the center of a political storm in the final days of the bloody protests. Wat Pathum became the venue of a disputed series of events, tarnishing the image of the country and triggering further allegations of human rights abuses by the current government and its armed forces. On May the 19th, the shrine, overwhelmed beyond capacity with people in every corner, became a target. Most of the protesters came from distant provinces. Others just needed a quick getaway from the day's fierce fighting. Nitayutan and Buntarika Sukontatat are ardent red shirt supporters. For months, they attended the anti-government protests. The two sisters were among those who fled the streets and entered the temple looking for sanctuary. The temple was their only option to escape the violence.
Tell me, when you arrived in the temple, what was it like? What was the atmosphere? What kind of people had gathered here? How many?
I saw soldiers shooting around the area, so I ran into the temple and the army was shooting. There were lots of explosions. I got scared, so everybody came inside the temple. We just wanted to survive. I saw green smoke, then someone climbed the fence of the police hospital. There was a door open, but everybody was in a hurry. I was going to go that way, but there were loads of people. There were a lot of explosions, so I ran in here.
Did you see people being injured? What was it like when there were attacks on people, on that night?
When I was in front of the stage, I saw people getting shot in the head. They were injured and dragged in front of me. Lots of people injured.
Kitty Chai Kang Kan, a red shirt supporter, was in hospital days after the fighting ended, being treated for bullet wounds.
What happened when that gunfire began at around 5 o'clock? Who was doing the shooting and where was the gunfire coming from?
When I got shot, I was hiding under a pickup truck in front of the temple. There were four or five of us. They shot at us from above. They shot me in the back. They called for us to come out. I came out and put up my hands and said, "I give up." And they shot me in my hand. So I went back underneath the truck. I was bleeding a lot, so I had to come out again. And they ordered me to take off my shirt and raise my hands. They were still on the bridge. They told me to run, so I ran to the nurse.
The nurse was 25-year-old Kamonket Akahad. She had been helping the sick and injured throughout the two-month-long protests. It was a role that came naturally to her.
She liked to help people since she was in primary school. And she was always involved with people who came to collect dead bodies. She was never scared of anything. So when she finished secondary school, she wanted to be an assistant nurse. When she graduated, she joined the hospital in the surgery. She got a lot of happiness from helping injured people. And she didn't want anything in return, because there are no returns in that area. And so I couldn't stop her, because that's the way she was.
Nitaya and Buntarika recall Kamonket attempting to ensure that those sheltering in the temple stayed out of harm's way.
I just saw her for the first time when I ran in here. I saw her standing in the front of the medical tent. She was saying, "Don't run outside, it's dangerous."
As the fighting engulfed the city, Kamonket's mother became increasingly concerned.
During the violence, the phones were cut off. I was at work. I would try to call her in my free time, but I never got connected. Until the last day, I got through to her. I asked her where she was. She said she was at the temple. I told her to go hide inside the temple, stay inside, because I could hear a lot of gunfire. I said, don't come home tonight, stay there. Come home tomorrow morning. That's the last time I spoke to her. She said she was going to help the injured, and then she hang up the phone. So I thought she was going to come home the next morning.
But Kamonket would never return home. As darkness fell over Bangkok, government troops closed in on the temple. For almost an hour, there was incessant gunfire in the area. Thai and foreign journalists, along with other observers on the scene, say soldiers fired into the grounds of Wat Pathum from the elevated commuter train nearby, a charge the government has denied. Fearing for their lives, protesters rushed into the safe zone, the injured desperate for medical assistance. Kamonket struggled to assist as many as she could, but in doing so, found herself in the firing line.
She was almost finished treating my wounds. Then they started shooting. She was reaching out to get some cotton, but before she even reached it, she was shot.
I went to pray to the Buddha. When I came out, there were people carrying dead bodies. There was a tall guy carrying the bodies. They kept bringing the bodies in the end line, them up against the stairs. Then this nurse was shot dead. We ran to the front and I saw other people carry her in, so I ran back in.
By the next morning, the fighting was over. And it emerged that six people had been shot dead inside the supposed safe haven of Wat Pathum Temple. Meanwhile, the Thai army displayed an array of weapons that they insisted had been left behind by red shirts who fled the shrine. Bolstering government claims that so-called terrorists had fired first against the military during the final days of the demonstrations.
What happened inside the temple with the people who took refuge there? Because, I mean, we've spoken to people who are inside who say quite categorically that they were being shot at by army snipers, and that's how people were killed inside the temple.
Let me just point out that this will have to be thoroughly investigated. And I understand that a lot of people in the temple were people who were really afraid that they would be shot by soldiers. And understandably so, because these are people who have been in the protest area for 2 months or so. We had said categorically that they would be facilitated to go home. Recall that the protests were called off at around 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. These incidents took place at around 7 o'clock in the evening. There's absolutely no reason why soldiers would be shooting at people. At all.
But that's what people are saying.
No, the presence of soldiers, they were there to protect the firemen, the volunteers who were going in to help put out the fire, and also to help injured people. I myself actually played a part in coordinating with the volunteers who go in to take the injured people out of the temple. I've talked to some of the people who witnessed firsthand the incident, and when you talk to them, they cannot confirm exactly where the people who shot them were and who they were, but it is a general buzz or belief in the temple that it would be the soldiers shooting. But I ask you, if that were the case, how come we could not facilitate the putting out of the fire in the nearby area? We couldn't get in, we couldn't have access, because there were people who were shooting at volunteers, who were shooting at soldiers, who were shooting at policemen.
Did you give the order to use live rounds?
We were very clear under what circumstances live bullets would be used. First of all, they would be in self-defense. They would be used to protect lives. And they can only be used at clear targets where you had people who were armed, who were about to cause damages in terms of lives, launching grenades or having actual clear weapons in their hands.
I don't think that's true. I was here from the beginning until the last day. There were no weapons. The weapons that the government showed to the media, I didn't see any of those.
I know the red shirts had slingshots. They just left those and firecrackers behind the temple.
I feel sad because the temple is sacred. But still the army shot in front. This shouldn't happen, but it did.
The fighting has left long-lasting scars, and they have been made deeper by the intrusion into a traditional place of worship. A peace shattered by an unexpected bloodshed. Kamonket's mother is desperate to find out why her daughter was killed while she was simply trying to help.
It's my daughter. She never hurt anyone. She went out to help people. Her intention was to help the injured and the dying. I want to know why they killed my daughter. For sure, the ones who shot her knew they were shooting a medic.
The killings in the temple have further divided opinion and, for those who lost loved ones, made the process of reconciliation even more difficult. The recent months of unrest, leaving over 800 people dead and more than 1,800 injured, have deepened and hardened the political fractures in Thailand. And these divisions have been in the making for a long time. For the last few years, the country's conflict focused on two warring factions, the Red and Yellow Shirts. Each side took to the streets with essentially non-violent protests, divided by their allegiance to two opposing personalities. Thaksin Shinawat, the exiled billionaire facing corruption charges, and Abasit Wachachiwa, the beleaguered head of the ruling coalition. The impasse between the groups continued until mid-March, when public protests seemed to become the exclusive preserve of the red shirts. Sarasha Pondu Masak is an ardent supporter of the Yellow Shirts. And during my last visit, she was an active participant in the movement's rallies. But now the Yellow Shirts had vanished from the streets as their opponents' demonstrations turned violent.
And the Yellow Shirts seem to be off the agenda. What's happened?
We're still here. We're still here. We're not active, obviously, because with such conflicts going on, I don't think it would be healthy to add to any more to the mix. The Yellow Shirts, we still stand for what we stood for way back. So we just let the Red Shirts do what they thought they needed to do. And there's really no need for us to come out and complicate things.
The ideological split between the Red and the Yellow Shirts is fundamentally socio-economic. The Reds are typically characterized as coming from the rural masses with heavy grievances towards a government they see as illegitimate and unrepresentative. Ironically, one of Thailand's richest men, ex-Prime Minister Thaksin, is the movement's figurehead. At the other end of the political spectrum are the Yellow Shirts, branded as an urban elite, educated and disconnected to the nation's growing economic gap. But many see such descriptions as an oversimplification.
They're trying to spin this off as a class war. And I think that's taking it a bit too far. Yes, there are very, very large divisions in terms of economics in Thailand. There's a very big gap between the agriculture sector, the farmers in the provinces, and us here in the big cities of the country. There's a huge gap there, and I'm not denying it. I'm just saying that somehow they're trying to turn the pro-Thaksin movement into something very, very different. And even taking Thaksin out of the equation, it's not going to solve problems in Thailand.
One major bone of contention is the unequivocal support the Red Camp displays for Thaksin. The yellow shirts are contemptuous of his image as a man of the people. This brings the government of Abbasid and the yellow-shirted People's Alliance for Democracy into an implicit accord.
We are in agreement with some of the things this government has done, but there are many things that we did not agree with the government in this particular government. So it's not that we threw our backing behind this government. We just think that they are the lesser of evils, I would say, in a political sense. So it was more of a, well, you know, we'll give them time to do what they think needs to be done, and we'll come back when we feel as though things are getting out of hand.
With the nation still reeling from the latest round of deadly demonstrations, this may be the last thing that is needed. In the midst of such deep political divisions, there is another color quietly advocating national unity. Pink is the neutral choice. By wearing the king's color, royalists pay homage to the single unifying element in Thai society, Phumipon Adunyadej. The 82-year-old king is the world's longest reigning monarch and seen as divine by his adoring subjects. Throughout the country's various political struggles over his six decades of rule, the king has stepped in on occasion, subtly advising political rivals to find a non-violent solution. The last time the aging monarch addressed the nation was 6 months before the vicious fighting.
My happiness is happening when the country is prosperous and peaceful. I am wishing all the people and nation to be more prosperous and sustainable. The progress and prosperity of the nation could happen only when every one of you work with conscious wisdom and honestly take the public and national benefit as paramount. The national benefit comes before the personal benefit.
Thailand has been through coups and periods of political instability before, but the one constant that has allowed this country to go through those periods has been the monarchy. Yet this crisis is different.
For the king remains confined to hospital. In late 2009, these grounds in front of the hospital where the king is convalescing were packed with well-wishers holding vigils. Now the courtyard is hushed, with few visitors to be seen. Tipa Nucharipon is one of the king's devotees who was here during my previous trip. She has continued to come in spite of the unrest.
While I was coming to the hospital, I was scared by the violence. But when I got here, I felt safe. I'm not scared about anything happening here, and I just want to be here. Even if I can't see him, just looking at his picture makes me happy. I'll never have a chance to talk to the king directly. In my opinion, I think he wants things to get better, to be harmonized. But no matter what the colors are, we're all the same.
He may not want to interfere. Political problems need to be solved by political measures. It is good that the king is not interfering in this affair, because if he does, he will expose himself to criticism that he is taking a side. He has done the right thing.
His devoted citizens refuse to express opinions on the subject of Thai politics. Pink is the safe option in Thailand. All Thais are expected to love the king, and any doubts are not tolerated.
I can still see him watching over his people. His people are not happy. He is also not happy. He loves them very much.
The silent monarch only adds to the uncertainties for the future of this divided nation. Prapada used to be indifferent to the debates dominated by the color-coded war, but the latest events have managed to catch her attention.
I saw Thais killing, shooting, bombing each other. But the thing that depresses me the most and that I cannot accept is the people condemning the monarchy. What they have said is impossible to accept. The king loves his people. How can they do this to him? How do they criticize him? I am in pain every time I hear anything against him. I only wish for normalcy. Let the king be happy for once. Don't the people know that he is very tired? I think the majority of Thais still love the king. I'm really sure about that.
Any criticism of the monarchy is illegal in Thailand, and the law is rigidly applied. As the political factions tear each other apart, labeling opponents as anti-monarchists is an effective way to discredit them. The Red Shirts, more than any other group, have been accused of being against the crown.
The other charge that the government has made against your movement is that you are against the monarchy, that you want a republic in Thailand. It's a charge that has stuck, isn't it?
This is an accusation in order to destroy political opponents without evidence. Because Thailand is very sensitive about this particular accusation. So the government is using our monarchy as a tool to destroy their enemy and make it beneficial for themselves. The accusation of being anti-monarchy has been raised to support the terrorism charge, which is weak. There is no evidence. It's a fact that we are all loyal to the king.
One of the things that people have said has introduced a level of political danger for Thailand is the use of the term anti-monarchists, which have been made towards the Red Shirt movement, that somehow they are disrespectful of the king, that they are anti-monarchy. That was a bad mistake, wasn't it,
Let me make this clear. When we talk about people who are terrorists, when we talk about people who have engaged in anti-monarchy movements, we're not talking about the majority or vast majority of the Red Shirt people. We've never said that. What we've said is that these elements exist. They have used the Red Shirt people as a shield, as a front. That's why we're separating these elements from the Red Shirt movement. We will reach out to people who have joined the Red Shirt movement to address their legitimate grievances, while at the same time, we have to deal with these elements according to the law. That's what we've said, and that's what we intend to do.
With accusations and allegations of misconduct on all sides, Thailand remains on a precipice. Last year's colour wars were just a prelude to the most recent months of rage, and with the promise of elections having been withdrawn, more bloodshed seems almost certain. In the days following the bloodshed of May the 19th, Bangkok's governor, Sukhumpan Boripat, worked desperately to try to bring the capital's citizens together. And, as a nation with a deep sense of spirituality, many of Thailand's people sought solace in their faith.
This is Lumpini Park in the heart of Bangkok. And only a week ago, it was well behind the barricade set up by the Red Shirts. But as you can see, hundreds of people are milling about, all jostling, trying to see the governor of Bangkok, who's here, in order to boost the morale of the people of Bangkok. Because this park is where a lot of violence took place, including the shooting by a sniper of one of the key leaders of the Red Shirts, General Khatia Sawastipol. But 1,000 monks have gathered here today in the same park in order to pray for Thailand's good fortune.
But the governor knows that it will take a lot more than prayers to solve the real long-term problems that the protests have created, especially economic problems. And ironically, the very people who participated in the protests, the predominantly rural and working class Red Shirts, might be the ones who will have to face the economic impact of their actions.
Smaller people always pay the price. The big businesses always have their buildings insured, but it's the smaller traders, the small retailers that are affected. And soon enough, the effects will be evident in the countryside when tourists don't come. For example, people who work in the city, you know, in traditional Thai massage shops, don't earn enough money to send home. The villagers will be affected. Maybe their parents are building a new home and relying on income money transfer from their children who work in Bangkok. Once this channel is dried up, they will not be able to complete their home.
Many of those people live and work here in the neighborhood of Bong Khai. Generations of them have left their villages and have come to Bangkok looking for economic opportunity. During the last days of the protests, Bong Khai had been completely shut down and was just beginning to come back to life a few days after May the 19th.
I couldn't sell anything, so I had no income. I had to sleep here and guard my store. I was scared that the protesters would come and burn my shop.
Normally, the profit I make in my daily sales is enough for me to live on. If I can't sell anything, then everything is affected. Food for my children, school fees, rent, food for my parents. So it really has a major impact on my life.
This normally thriving market was caught right on the front lines between the army and the red shirt protesters. And people here were really affected. In fact, at this point, the army and the security forces are giving out aid to the local residents. And Thailand's economy, the second largest in all of Southeast Asia, is expected to take a huge knock as a result of the political turmoil, with tourism set to drop by as much as $3.5 billion this year. And also, Thais themselves are going to be spending a lot less in the coming months, with an expectation of more trouble ahead.
Since the end of the protests, Thailand's government has been trying with a great degree of urgency to show the world that things in this country are back to normal. Streets were cleaned up and Thailand's politicians returned to the mundane but essential tasks of running a country. But the fundamental political issues, those concerning Prime Minister Abbasid's legitimacy and his government's perceived disconnect from the rural and working class people of the north and the northeast, remain unresolved.
Thailand is left in a very precarious position now, because one of the deepening sense of grievances amongst the red shirts is the idea that the Bangkok elite is what is underpinning your governments, that somehow the red shirt movement, which is made up of the provincial poor largely, their grievances have not been addressed.
Well, I don't think that's...
But there is a growing regionalism to this crisis that is dangerous for Thailand.
That's not quite an accurate description. First of all, I don't think that you could say that there was a true urban-rural divide. If you took, and you could see from the polls of the support for protests and for what the government had done, it's not immediately clear. Yes, there are some regional differences, and you see that in all countries in terms of political support. But what the government intends to do in our reconciliation plan, and part of which is to really address the issue of disparities. And the urban people, the Bangkok people, do not deny the need to give opportunities to rural people. And that's the basis from which we work from.
What do you think will happen next? In terms of, as you said, Bangkok is coming back to life. The raucous traffic is back to its usual levels. I mean, there is a sense of normal life coming back, but there isn't a sense of normal life coming back to the politics of this country. How do you and what do you plan to do in order to try and at least stabilize the political divisions?
Well, we still have to be mindful of the risk of violence. And that's what we will do. Obviously, the differences between the parties are wide, and we need to do all we can to try to bridge that gap. And again, I would refer back to the reconciliation plan that I've proposed. During the budget debate, I think some of members of the opposition parties have echoed the need to pursue that plan, and that's what we intend to do.
But you don't believe for a minute that the thrust and the depths of feeling within the red shirt movement has gone away. I mean, this is not the end of the affair.
No, and that's why I say that we continue to have to address the grievances of people who have joined the red shirt movement. And the plan is intended and designed to address those.
Add to that the more than 80 people dead and over 1,800 injured in this year's protests. The red shirts already see those losses as too great, and this government's actions unforgivable. Images and stories of their people being attacked by the Thai army and, by extension, Abbasid's government are fueling resentment.
I mean, I ask you again, do you feel a sense of responsibility for the loss of life and the actions that your government took in contributing to that?
Personally, and I'm sure I speak also for people who've worked with me, we all regret the losses that have happened. But we will have a thorough investigation of what's happened, and we will do whatever is appropriate once the truth becomes clear. We have a number of processes by which we can get at the truth. The Human Rights Commission is working on this. I intend to set up an independent commission to look into the facts. So I think it would be more appropriate once the truth and the findings of these commissions come out to begin to talk about who should be held responsible for these losses.
When I was last here in 2009, Abbasid's government had sent in the army to crack down on the red shirts and had put an end to their protest. But in 2010, the red shirts had returned in larger numbers and with much more ferocity. After yet another violent suppression, they remain determined.
Do you think that now that the protests have been ended by force, that that will be the end, that there will be no more red shirt protests in the future?
I don't think they will stop. It will continue.
In my heart, in my opinion, it will continue. I think there will be more, because there's still no democracy and there's a double standard in this country. We want to fight.
When the people eventually finds out the truth about the government's lies, when that day comes, the people will rise again. The way we see it, even if the people have been defeated, they've done everything the right way. But we did not anticipate that this government can be so ruthless and cruel, so the fight has not stopped. The only reason we stopped the protests was to avoid further loss of life. But that doesn't mean that we will give up. The more we are attacked, the more we will fight back.
Thais are now struggling to decide not only who will run their country, but also what kind of country they want it to be.
Thailand is going through what I would call growing pains. We're a developing society that needs to go through the pains of developing our democracy. And in that process, I think there will be such incidents. And I don't think that this is the last of it, unfortunately. But
do you think it's going to go on? As someone put it, it's the end of the beginning.
Well, I would agree. I would agree. I don't think this is the end of anything. If not, it's becoming more and more polarized. And that is okay if everybody resorts to not using violence.
But over a year of living dangerously, the people of this city have endured unprecedented rage, hatred, and violence. The political divide in Thai society has deepened. If the people who run this country fail to deal with those divisions soon, Thailand might burn once again.